Hallucinations of many sorts, including musical ones, may also occur if the senses and the perceptual systems of the brain have too little stimulation. The circumstances have to be extreme. Such sensory deprivation is not likely to occur in ordinary life, but it may occur if one is immersed for days on end in deep stillness and silence. David Oppenheim was a professional clarinet player and a university dean when he wrote to me in 1988. He was 66, with some mild, high-frequency hearing loss. A few years earlier, he wrote, he had spent a week at a monastery retreat, deep in the woods, where he took part in a session, an intense meditation practice of 9 or more hours a day. After 2 or 3 days of this, he started to hear faint music, which he took to be people singing around a distant campfire. The following year he returned, and once again he heard the distant singing, but soon the music got louder and more specific. At its height, the music is quite loud, he wrote. It is repetitive and orchestral in nature. It is all slow passages from Dvorak and Wagner. The presence of this musical track makes the meditation impossible. I can summon up Dvorak, Wagner, or anyone else when not in meditation, but I don't hear them. In the session version, I hear them. There is obsessive repetition of the same musical material over and over for days at a time. The inner musician cannot be stopped or shut up, but he can be controlled and manipulated. I was successful in banishing the Pilgrim's Chorus from Tannhauser by changing it into the slow movement from Mozart's lovely Symphony 25 in A major, because they start out with the same intervals. Not all of his hallucinations were of familiar music. Some of it he composed. But, he added, I don't compose at all in my everyday life. I used the word to indicate that at least one of the pieces that played in my head was not Dvorak or Wagner, but new music that I was somehow making up. I have heard similar accounts from some of my friends. Jerome Bruner tells me that when he sailed the Atlantic solo, and there were calm days with little to do, he sometimes heard classical music stealing across the water. Michael Sundu, a botanist, recently wrote to me about his own experience as a novice sailor. I was 24 years old, working as a member of a crew that was hired to deliver a sailboat. We were at sea for a total of 22 days. It was very boring. After the first 3 days, I had read every book that I brought with me. There was nothing to do for entertainment except to watch the clouds and take naps. For days and days there was no wind, so we simply puttered along at a few knots by running the engine while the sails luffed. I would lie on my back on the deck or on a bench in a cabin and stare out through the plexiglass window. It was during these long days of complete inactivity that I had several musical hallucinations. Two of the hallucinations began from the monotonous and ever-present sounds that were generated by the boat itself. These were the buzzing of the reefer, the small refrigerator, and the whistling sound of the rigging in the wind. Each of these sounds transformed into never-ending instrumental solos. The transformation into music was such that the original sound and its source were forgotten, and I lay there in my lethargic state for long stretches of time, just listening to what sounded like stunning and beautiful compositions. Only after enjoying each of these in a sort of daydream-like state did I figure out what the sources of noise were. The instrumental sounds themselves were interesting in that they were not anything I typically listen to for enjoyment. The buzzing noise of the reefer to me sounded like a virtuoso heavy metal guitar solo, an onslaught of high-pitched strings played quickly through a distorting amplifier. The whistling sound of the rigging took on the form of Highland Scottish bagpipes with a set of drones and a melody line. The sounds of both of these types of music are familiar to me, but neither are things that I would generally play on my home stereo. Around the same time, I would also hear my father's voice call my name. As far as I know, there was no sound which triggered this. At one point, I also had a visual hallucination of a shark's fin emerging from the water. It took no time at all for my companions to discredit my claim that I had seen a shark. They laughed at me. I think from their reaction that seeing sharks was a very common reaction for inexperienced sailors to have. Although Coleman, in 1894, wrote specifically about hallucinations in the Seine associated with local organic disease of the sensory organs, etc., the impression has long remained, both in the popular mind and among physicians too, that hallucinations mean psychosis, or gross organic disease of the brain. The reluctance to observe the common phenomenon of hallucinations in the Seine before the 1970s was perhaps influenced by the fact that there was no theory of how such hallucinations could occur until 1967, when Jerzy Konorski, a Polish neurophysiologist, devoted several pages of his Integrative Activity of the Brain to the physiological basis of hallucinations. Konorski inverted the question, "Why do hallucinations occur?" to, "Why do hallucinations not occur all the time? What constrains them?" He conceived a dynamic system which, he wrote, can generate perceptions, images, and hallucinations. The mechanism producing hallucinations is built into our brains, but it can be thrown into operation only in some exceptional conditions. Konorski brought together evidence, weak in the 1960s, but overwhelming now, that there are not only afferent connections going from the sense organs to the brain, but retro-connections going in the other direction. Such retro-connections may be sparse compared to the afferent connections and may not be activated under normal circumstances. But they provide, Konorski felt, the essential anatomical and physiological means by which hallucinations can be generated. What, then, normally prevents this from happening? The crucial factor, Konorski suggested, is the sensory input from eyes, ears, and other sense organs, which normally inhibits any backflow of activity from the highest parts of the cortex to the periphery. But if there is a critical deficiency of input from the sense organs, this will facilitate a backflow, producing hallucinations physiologically and subjectively indistinguishable from perceptions. There is normally no such reduction of input in conditions of silence or darkness, because off units fire up and produce continuous activity. Konorski's theory provided a simple and beautiful explanation for what soon came to be called release hallucinations, associated with de-afferentation. Such an explanation now seems obvious, almost tautological, but it required originality and audacity to propose it in the 1960s. There is now good evidence from brain imaging studies to support Konorski's idea. In 2000, Timothy Griffiths published a detailed and pioneering report on the neural basis of musical hallucinations. He was able to show, using PET scans, that musical hallucinations were associated with a widespread activation of the same neural networks that are normally activated during the perception of actual music. In 1995, I received a vivid letter from June B., a charming and creative woman of 70, telling me of her musical hallucinations. This first started last November, when I was visiting my sister and brother-in-law one night. After turning off the TV and preparing to retire, I started hearing Amazing Grace. It was being sung by a choir over and over again. I checked with my sister to see if they had some church service on TV, but they had Monday Night Football or some such. So I went on to the deck, overlooking the water. The music followed me. I looked down on the quiet coastline and the few houses with lights and realized that the music couldn't possibly be coming from anywhere in that area. It had to be in my head. Mrs. B. enclosed her playlist, which included Amazing Grace, The Battle Hymn of the Republic, Beethoven's Ode to Joy, the drinking song from La Traviata, A Tisket, A Tasket, and a really dreary version of We Three Kings of Orient Are. One night, Mrs. B. wrote, I heard a splendidly solemn rendition of Old MacDonald Had a Farm, followed by thunderous applause. At that moment, I decided that, as I was obviously completely bonkers, I'd better have the matter looked into. Mrs. B. described how she had tests for Lyme disease. She had read that this could cause musical hallucinations, brainstem-evoked audiometry, an EEG, and an MRI. During her EEG, she heard the bells of St. Mary's, but nothing abnormal showed. She had no signs of hearing loss. Her musical hallucinations tended to occur during quiet moments, especially when she went to bed. I can never turn the music on or off, but I can sometimes change the melody, not to just anything I want to hear, but to something that has already been programmed. Sometimes the songs overlap. I can't stand another minute, so I turn on WQXR and go to sleep by some real music. I asked her later whether she had other simpler hallucinations. Sometimes just ding-dong, ding-dong, she replied, the dong a fifth lower than the ding, maddeningly repeated hundreds of times. I'm very fortunate, Mrs. B. concluded, that my music isn't all that loud. If it were, I'd really go crazy. It takes over in quiet moments. Any audio distractions, conversation, radio, TV, effectively drown out whatever I'm hearing. You observe that I seem to get on with my new addition amiably. Well, I can cope okay, but it can be very annoying. When I wake up at 5 a.m. and can't get back to sleep, I don't appreciate having a chorus reminding me that the old grey mare ain't what she used to be. This is not a joke. It really did happen, and I might have thought it amusing if it hadn't kept singing the same refrain over and over again. A decade after she first wrote to me, I met with Mrs. B., and I asked her whether, after so many years, her hallucinated music had become important in her life, in either a positive or a negative way. If it went away, I asked, would you be pleased or would you miss it? Miss it, she answered at once. I would miss the music. You see, it is now a part of me. While there is no doubt of the physiological basis of musical hallucinations, one has to wonder to what extent other, let us call them psychological factors, may enter into the initial selection of the hallucinations and their subsequent evolution and role. I wondered about such factors when I wrote in 1985 about Mrs. O.C. and Mrs. O.M. Wilder Penfield, too, had wondered whether there was any sense or significance in the songs or scenes evoked in experiential seizures, but had decided there was not. The selection of hallucinatory music, he had concluded, was quite at random, except that there is some evidence of cortical conditioning. Rodolfo Linus, similarly, has written of the incessant activity in the nuclei of the basal ganglia, and how they seem to act as a continuous random motor pattern noise generator. When a pattern or fragment might escape now and then and thrust into consciousness a song or a few bars of music, Linus felt this was purely abstract and without its apparent emotional counterpart. But something may start randomly, a tick, for example, bursting out of overexcited basal ganglia, and then acquire associations and meaning. One may use the word random with regard to the effects of a low-level mishap in the basal ganglia, in the involuntary movement called chorea, for example. There is no personal element in chorea. It is wholly an automatism. It does not, for the most part, even make its way to consciousness, and may be more visible to others than to the patient himself. But random is a word one would hesitate to use in regard to experiences, whether these are perceptual, imaginary, or hallucinatory. Musical hallucinations draw upon the musical experience and memories of a lifetime, and the importance that particular sorts of music have for the individual must surely play a major role. The sheer weight of exposure may also play a significant part, even overriding personal taste. The vast majority of musical hallucinations tend to take the form of popular songs or theme music, and, in an earlier generation, hymns and patriotic songs, even in professional musicians or very sophisticated listeners. Musical hallucinations tend to reflect the tastes of the times more than the tastes of the individual. Some people, a few, come to enjoy their musical hallucinations. Many are tormented by them. Most, sooner or later, reach some kind of accommodation or understanding with them. This may sometimes take the form of direct interaction, as in A Charming Case History published by Timothy Miller and T.W. Crosby. Their patient, an elderly deaf lady, awoke one morning hearing a gospel quartet singing an old hymn she remembered from childhood days. Once she had ascertained that the music was not coming from a radio or television, she rather calmly accepted that it was coming from inside my head. The choir's repertoire of hymns increased. The music was generally pleasing, and the patient often enjoyed singing along with the quartet. She also found that she could teach the quartet new songs by thinking of a few lines, and the quartet would supply any forgotten words or verses. Miller and Crosby observed that a year later the hallucinations were unchanged, adding that their patient had adjusted well to her hallucinations and views them as a cross she must bear. Yet bearing a cross may not carry a wholly negative connotation. It can also be a sign of favour, of election. I recently had occasion to see a remarkable old lady, a pastor, who developed musical hallucinations, mostly of hymns, as she became hard of hearing. She came to see her hallucinations as a gift, and has trained them to a considerable extent, so that they occur while she is in church or at prayer, but not at mealtimes, for instance. She has incorporated her musical hallucinations into a deeply felt religious context. Such personal influences are fully allowed, indeed required, in Konorski's model, and in Linus's too. Fragmentary music patterns may be emitted or released from the basal ganglia as raw music without any emotional colouring or associations, music which is, in this sense, meaningless. But these musical fragments make their way to the thalamocortical systems that underlie consciousness and self, and there they are elaborated and clothed with meaning and feeling and associations of all sorts. By the time such fragments reach consciousness, meaning and feeling have already been attached. Perhaps the most intensive analysis of musical hallucinations and their shaping by personal experience and feeling, their continuing interaction with the mind and personality, has been pursued by the eminent psychoanalyst Leo Rangel. For Rangel, musical hallucinations have been the subject of continuing self-study that has lasted now for more than a decade. Dr. Rangel first wrote to me about his musical hallucinations in 1996. Rangel, now in his 93rd year, continues to practice as a psychoanalyst and is writing a book about his musical hallucinations. He was 82 and had had a second bypass surgery a few months before. Immediately upon awakening in the ICU, I heard singing, which made me say to my children, "Hey, there's a rabbi school out there." It sounded to me like an old rabbi who was teaching young rabbi students how to sing and perform their things. I told my family the rabbi must work late, even midnight, since I heard the music then, too. My kids looked at each other and said amusedly and tolerantly, "There's no rabbi school out there." I, of course, soon began to know this was me. This gave me both relief and concern. The music must have been continuous, but I paid little or no attention to it for large blocks of time, especially during the busy hospital routines. When I left the hospital after 6 days, the rabbi followed me. He was now outside my windows at home, towards the hills. Or was he in the canyon? On my first plane trip a few weeks later, he came with me. Rangel had hoped that these musical hallucinations, perhaps, he thought, a product of the anesthesia or the morphine he had received after surgery, would go away with time. He had also experienced copious cognitive distortions, which every bypass patient I know has had, but these had quickly cleared up. After 6 months, however, he feared they were becoming permanent. During the day, he could often push the music aside when otherwise absorbed, but at night, the musical hallucinations kept him awake. "I feel quite ragged from lack of sleep," he wrote. Dr. Rangel did have a significant hearing loss. "I have had nerve deafness for many years now, familial. The musical hallucinosis is related, I feel, to the hyperacusis that goes with the hypohearing. The internal central auditory pathways must overwork and enhance sounds." He speculated that this overactivity of auditory brain pathways might at first be based on external rhythms of wind, traffic, or humming motors, or on internal rhythms of breath or heartbeat, and that the mind then converts these to music or song, establishing control over it. Passivity is overcome by activity. Dr. Rangel felt that his internal music reflected his moods and circumstances. At first, in the hospital, the songs varied. They were sometimes funereal, elegiac, rabbinical, sometimes lilting and happy. "Oh la la, ooh la la," alternating with "oy vey, oy vey, oy vey, vey, vey." Later he realized these were to the same tune. When he was due to come home from the hospital, he began to hear "When Johnny Comes Marching Home Again," and then jaunty jolly ones like "Alouette, Gentil Alouette." "When there is no official song that comes on by itself," he continued, "my brain mind makes one up. The rhythmic sounds are put to music, often with nonsense words. Maybe the last words someone said, or I read, or heard, or thought." This phenomenon, he felt, was related to creativity, like dreams. I continued to correspond with Dr. Rangel, and in 2003 he wrote, "I have lived with this thing now for almost 8 years. The symptom is always there. One senses it is 24/7. But to say that it is always with me does not mean that I am always aware of it. That would indeed send me to a loony house. It is part of me, in that it is there whenever I think about it, or whenever my mind is not occupied, that is, attending to something. But I can bring the tunes on in the most effortless way. I have but to think about one bar of music or one word of a lyric, and the total work rushes in and gets going. It is like the most sensitive remote control. It then stays as long as it wishes, or as long as I let it. It is like a radio with only a turn-on key." Rangel has lived with his musical hallucinations for more than 10 years now, and increasingly they seem less meaningless, less random to him. The songs are all from his younger years, and they can be categorized, he wrote. They are romantic, or poignant, or tragic, or celebratory, about love, or make me cry, everything. All bring memories. Many are of my wife. She passed away 7 years ago, a year and a half after this began. They are structurally like a dream. They have a precipitating stimulus, relate to affects, bring back thoughts automatically, whether I want to or not, are cognitive as well, have a substructure if I want to pursue them. Sometimes when the music stopped, I would find myself humming the tune I had just wished would please stop. I found I missed it. Every psychoanalyst knows that in every symptom, and this is a symptom, behind every defense is a wish. The songs that come to the surface carry urges, hopes, wishes, romantic, sexual, moral, aggressive wishes, as well as urges for action and mastery. They are, in fact, what brought my musical hallucinations to their final shape, neutralizing and replacing the original interfering noise. Complain as I will, the song is welcome, at least partially so. Summarizing his experiences in a long article published online in the Huffington Post, Rangel wrote, "I consider myself a kind of living laboratory, an experiment in nature through an auditory prism. I have been living at the edge, but a very special edge, the border between the brain and the mind. From here, the vistas are wide, in several directions. The fields over which these experiences roam cover neurologic, otologic, and psychoanalytic realms, converging into a unique symptomatic combination of them all, lived and experienced not on a controlled couch, but on the stage of an ongoing life. Part 2. A Range of Musicality. Chapter 7. Sense and Sensibility. A Range of Musicality. We often speak of people as having or not having a good ear. A good ear means, as a start, having an accurate perception of pitch and rhythm. We know that Mozart had a wonderful ear and, of course, he was a sublime artist. We take it that all good musicians must have a decent ear, even if not one of Mozartian caliber. But is a good ear sufficient? This comes up in Rebecca West's partly autobiographical novel The Fountain Overflows, a story of life in a musical family, with a mother who is a professional musician, like West's own mother, an intellectually brilliant but unmusical father, and three children, two of whom, like their mother, are deeply musical. The best ear, however, belongs to the unmusical child, Cordelia. She, in her sister's words, had a true ear. Indeed, she had absolute pitch, which neither Mama nor Mary nor I had. And she had supple fingers. She could bend them right back to the wrist, and she could read anything at sight. But Mama's face crumpled, first with rage, and then, just in time, with pity, every time she heard Cordelia laying the bow over the strings. Her tone was horribly greasy, and her phrasing always sounded like a stupid grown-up explaining something to a child. Also, she did not know good music from bad, as we did, as we had always done. It was not Cordelia's fault that she was unmusical. Mama had often explained that to us. She had taken her inheritance from Papa. An opposite situation is described in Somerset Maugham's story The Alien Corn. Here, the elegant young son of a newly ennobled family, being groomed for a gentleman's life of hunting and shooting, develops, to his family's dismay, a passionate desire to be a pianist. A compromise is reached, in which the young man goes to Germany to study music, with the understanding that he will return to England after 2 years and submit himself to the opinion of a professional pianist. When the time comes, George, newly returned from Munich, takes his place at the piano. Leah Maycart, a famous pianist, has come down for the day, and all the family is gathered around. George throws himself into the music, playing Chopin with a great deal of brio. But something is amiss, as the narrator observes. I wish I knew music well enough to give an exact description of his playing. It had strength and a youthful exuberance, but I felt that he missed what is to me the peculiar charm of Chopin, the tenderness, the nervous melancholy, the wistful gaiety and the slightly faded romance that reminds me always of an early Victorian keepsake. And again I had the vague sensation, so slight that it almost escaped me, that the two hands did not quite synchronize. I looked at Ferdy and saw him give his sister a look of faint surprise. Muriel's eyes were fixed on the pianist, but presently she dropped them and for the rest of the time stared at the floor. His father looked at him too, and his eyes were steadfast. But unless I was much mistaken, he went pale, and his face betrayed something like dismay. Music was in the blood of all of them. All their lives they had heard the greatest pianists in the world, and they judged with instinctive precision. The only person whose face betrayed no emotion was Leah Maycart. She listened very attentively. She was as still as an image in a niche. Finally, Maycart delivered her judgment. If I thought you had in you the makings of an artist, I shouldn't hesitate to beseech you to give up everything for art's sake. Art is the only thing that matters. In comparison with art, wealth and rank and power are not worth a straw. Of course, I can see that you've worked very hard. Don't think it's been wasted. It will always be a pleasure to you to be able to play the piano, and it will enable you to appreciate great playing as no ordinary person can hope to do. But George had neither the hands nor the ear, she continued, to become a first-rate pianist, not in 1,000 years. George and Cordelia are both incurably deficient in their musicality, though in quite different ways. George has drive, energy, dedication, a passionate feeling for music, but he lacks some basic neurological competence. His ear is deficient. Cordelia, on the other hand, has a perfect ear, but one has the feeling that she will never get musical phrasing, will never improve her greasy tone, never be able to tell good music from bad, because she is profoundly deficient, although she does not realize it, in musical sensibility and taste. Does musical sensibility, musicality in the most general sense, also demand a specific neurological potential? Most of us can hope that there may be some harmony, some alignment, between our desires and our powers and our opportunities. But there will always be those, like George, whose abilities do not match their desires, and those, like Cordelia, who seem to have every talent except the most important one, judgment or taste. No one has all the talents, cognitively or emotionally. Even Tchaikovsky was keenly aware that his great fertility in melody was not matched by a comparable grasp of musical structure, but he had no desire to be a great architectonic composer like Beethoven. He was perfectly happy to be a great melodic one. Many of the patients or correspondents I describe in this book are conscious of musical misalignments of one sort or another. The musical parts of their brains are not entirely at their service, and may indeed seem to have a will of their own. This is the case, for example, with musical hallucinations, which are imposed upon and not sought by those who have them, and are thus quite different from the musical imagery or imagination one feels to be one's own. On the performance side, this is what happens with musicians' dystonia, when the fingers refuse to obey one's will and curl up or show a will of their own. In such circumstances, a part of the brain is at odds with one's intentionality, oneself. Even if there is no misalignment of a gross sort, where mind and brain are in conflict with one another, musicality, like other gifts, can create its own problems. I think here of the eminent composer Tobias Picker, who also, as it happens, has Tourette's syndrome. Soon after I met him, he told me that he had a congenital disorder that had bullied him all his life. I assumed that he was talking about his Tourette's, but he said no. The congenital disorder was his great musicality. He had, it seemed, been born with this. He had recognized and tapped out tunes in the first years of life, and had started to play the piano and compose at 4. By the age of 7, he could reproduce long and elaborate pieces of music after a single hearing, and constantly found himself overwhelmed by musical emotion. He said that it was understood, practically from the start, that he would be a musician, and that he had little chance of doing anything else, because his musicality was all-consuming. He would not, I think, have had it any other way, but he sometimes felt that his musicality controlled him rather than the other way around. Many artists and performers no doubt have the same feeling at times, but with music, as with mathematics, such abilities can be especially precocious and may determine one's life from a very early age. Listening to Picker's music, watching him play or compose, I have the feeling that he has a special brain, a musician's brain, very different from my own. It is a brain that works differently and has connections, whole fields of activity that mine lacks. It is difficult to know how much such differences may be congenital, as Picker puts it, and how much they are the result of training? A tricky question, since Picker, like many musicians, began intensive musical training in early childhood. With the development of brain imaging in the 1990s, it became possible to actually visualize the brains of musicians and to compare them with those of non-musicians. Using MRI morphometry, Gottfried Schlaug at Harvard and his colleagues made careful comparisons of the sizes of various brain structures. In 1995, they published a paper showing that the corpus callosum, the great commissure that connects the two hemispheres of the brain, is enlarged in professional musicians, and that a part of the auditory cortex, the planum temporal, has an asymmetric enlargement in musicians with absolute pitch. Schlaug et al. Went on to show increased volumes of gray matter in motor, auditory, and visuospatial areas of the cortex, as well as in the cerebellum. Anatomists today would be hard put to identify the brain of a visual artist, a writer, or a mathematician, but they could recognize the brain of a professional musician without a moment's hesitation. How much, Schlaug wondered, are these differences a reflection of innate predisposition, and how much an effect of early musical training? One does not, of course, know what distinguishes the brains of musically gifted four-year-olds before they start musical training, but the effects of such training, Schlaug and his colleagues showed, are very great. The anatomical changes they observed with musicians' brains were strongly correlated with the age at which musical training began and with the intensity of practice and rehearsal. Alvaro Pascual Leone at Harvard has shown how rapidly the brain responds to musical training. Using five-finger piano exercises as a training test, he has demonstrated that the motor cortex can show changes within minutes of practicing such sequences. Measurements of regional blood flow in different parts of the brain, moreover, have shown increased activity in the basal ganglia and the cerebellum, as well as various areas of the cerebral cortex, not only with physical practice, but with mental practice alone. There is clearly a wide range of musical talent, but there is much to suggest there is an innate musicality in virtually everyone. This has been shown most clearly by the use of the Suzuki method to train young children, entirely by ear and by imitation, to play the violin. Virtually all hearing children respond to such training. Even profoundly deaf people may have innate musicality. Deaf people often love music and are very responsive to rhythm, which they feel as vibration, not as sound. The acclaimed percussionist, Evelyn Glennie, has been profoundly deaf since the age of 12. It has been said that even a brief exposure to classical music can stimulate or enhance mathematical, verbal, and visuospatial abilities in children, the so-called Mozart effect. This has been disputed by Schellenberg and others, but what is beyond dispute is the effect of intensive early musical training on the young plastic brain. Takako Fujioka and her colleagues, using magnetoencephalography to examine auditory evoked potentials in the brain, have recorded striking changes in the left hemisphere of children who have had only a single year of violin training compared to children with no training. Can musical competence be seen as a universal human potential in the same way as linguistic competence? There is exposure to language in every household, and virtually all children develop linguistic competence, in a Chomskyan sense, by the age of 4 or 5. This may not be the case with regard to music, since some households may be almost devoid of music, and musical potential, like other potentials, needs stimulation to develop fully. In the absence of encouragement or stimulation, musical talents may not develop. But while there is a fairly well-defined critical period for language acquisition in the first years of life, this is less so for music. To be languageless at the age of 6 or 7 is a catastrophe. It is only likely to occur in the case of deaf children, given no effective access to either sign or speech. But to be musicless at the same age does not necessarily predict a musicless future. My friend, Jerry Marks, grew up with very little exposure to music. His parents never went to concerts and rarely listened to music on the radio. There were no instruments or books on music in the house. Jerry was puzzled when classmates talked about music, and he wondered why they were so interested in it. "I had a tin ear," he recalled. "I could not sing a tune, I could not tell if others sang in tune, and I could not distinguish one note from another." A precocious child, Jerry was passionate about astronomy, and he seemed all set for a life of science, without music. But when he was 14, he became fascinated by acoustics, especially the physics of vibrating strings. He read about this and did experiments in the school lab, but increasingly craved a stringed instrument for himself. His parents gave him a guitar for his 15th birthday, and he soon taught himself to play. The sounds of the guitar and the feeling of plucked strings excited him, and he learned rapidly. By the time he was 17, he came in third in a contest for the most musical in his senior class in high school. His high school friend, Stephen J. Gould, musical from infancy, came in second. Jerry went on to major in music at college, where he supported himself by teaching guitar and banjo. A passion for music has been central to his life ever since. Nevertheless, there are limits imposed by nature. Having absolute pitch, for example, is highly dependent on early musical training, but such training cannot, by itself, guarantee absolute pitch. Nor, as Cordelia shows, can the presence of absolute pitch guarantee that there will be other, higher musical gifts. Cordelia's planum temporale was no doubt well developed, but perhaps she was a bit lacking in prefrontal cortex, in judgment. George, on the other hand, while doubtless well endowed in those areas of the brain involved in emotional reaction to music, may have been lacking in other areas. The examples of George and Cordelia introduce a theme that will be echoed and explored in many of the clinical case histories that follow, that what one calls musicality comprises a great range of skills and receptivities, from the most elementary perceptions of pitch and tempo to the highest aspects of musical intelligence and sensibility, and that, in principle, all of these are dissociable one from another. All of us, indeed, are stronger in some aspects of musicality, weaker in others, and so have some kinship to both Cordelia and George. Chapter 8. Things Fall Apart. Amusia and Disharmonia. We take our senses for granted. We feel we are given the visual world, for example, complete with depth, color, movement, form, and meaning all perfectly matched and synchronous. Given this seeming unity, it may not occur to us that there are many different elements composing a single visual scene, and that all of these have to be separately analyzed and then put together. This composite nature of visual perception may be more apparent to an artist or a photographer, or it may become apparent when, due to some damage or failure of development, one element or another is defective or lost. The perception of color has its own neural basis, and so, too, have the perception of depth, motion, form, and so on. But even if all of these preliminary perceptions are working, there may be difficulty synthesizing them into a visual scene or object with meaning. Someone with such a higher-order defect here, a visual agnosia, for example, may be able to copy a picture or paint a scene so that others can recognize it, but they themselves cannot. It is similar with hearing and with the special complexities of music. There are many elements involved, all concerned with the perception, decoding and synthesis of sound and time, and thus there are many forms of amusia. A.L. Benton, in his chapter on the amusias in Critchley and Henson's Music and the Brain, distinguishes receptive from interpretive or performance amusia and identifies more than a dozen varieties. There are forms of rhythm deafness, slight or profound, congenital or acquired. Che Guevara was famously rhythm deaf, He might be seen dancing a mambo while the orchestra was playing a tango. He also had considerable tone deafness. But, especially after a left hemisphere stroke, one can develop profound forms of rhythm deafness without tone deafness, just as, after some right hemisphere strokes, a patient may develop tone deafness without rhythm deafness. In general, though, forms of rhythm deafness are rarely total, because rhythm is represented widely in the brain. There are also cultural forms of rhythm deafness. Thus, as Erin Hannon and Sandra Trehub have reported, infants at 6 months can readily detect all rhythmic variations, but by 12 months their range has narrowed, albeit sharpened. They can now more easily detect the types of rhythms to which they have previously been exposed. They learn and internalize a set of rhythms for their culture. Adults find it harder still to perceive foreign rhythmic distinctions. Having been raised on Western classical music, I have no difficulty with its relatively simple rhythms and time signatures, but I get confused by the more complex rhythms of tangos or mambos, to say nothing of the syncopations and polyrhythms of jazz or African music. Culture and exposure determine some of one's tonal sensitivities as well. Thus, someone like myself may find the diatonic scale more natural and more orienting than the 22-note scales of Hindu music. But there does not seem to be any innate neurological preference for particular types of music, any more than there are for particular languages. The only indispensable elements of music are discrete tones and rhythmic organization. Many of us are unable to sing or whistle in tune, though usually we are very conscious of this. We do not have an amusia. But true tone deafness is present in perhaps 5% of the population, and people with such an amusia can veer off-key without realizing it, or be unable to recognize off-key singing by others. Sometimes tone deafness can be quite gross. I used to attend a small temple that employed a cantor who could hit jarringly wrong notes, sometimes a third of an octave away from where he should have been. He particularly fancied himself a cantillator and would embark on elaborate tonal excursions of a sort that require a very good ear, but he would get completely lost in these. When I complained discreetly to the rabbi one day about the cantor's singing, I was told that he was a man of exemplary piety and that he did his best. I said I had no doubt of this, but that one could not have a tone-deaf cantor. This was, to anyone musical, akin to having a clumsy surgeon. Florence Foster Jenkins, a coloratura who attracted a sell-out audience to Carnegie Hall in her time, considered herself a great singer and attempted the most difficult operatic arias, arias that required a flawless ear as well as an extraordinary vocal range. But she would sing notes that were excruciatingly wrong, flat, even screechy, without, apparently, realizing that she was doing so. Her sense of rhythm was also terrible, but audiences continued to flock to her concerts, which always featured great theatrics and many costume changes. Whether her fans were devoted to her in spite of her lack of musicality or because of it is not clear. Those with gross tone deafness can still enjoy music and enjoy singing. Amusia, in its absolute sense, total amusia, is another matter, for here tones are not recognized as tones, and music, therefore, is not experienced as music. Some of the classic cases in the neurological literature describe this. Henri Ecquien and Martin L. Albert noted that for such people, melodies lose their musical quality and may acquire a non-musical, disagreeable character. They described one man, a former singer, who complained of hearing a screeching car whenever he heard music. I found these descriptions almost unimaginable until I experienced amusia myself on two occasions, both in 1974. On the first, I was driving along the Bronx River Parkway, listening to a Chopin ballade on the radio, when a strange alteration of the music occurred. The beautiful piano tones started to lose their pitch and their character, and were reduced within a couple of minutes to a sort of toneless banging with an unpleasant metallic reverberation, as if the ballade were being played with a hammer on sheet metal. Though I had lost all sense of melody, I had no impairment of rhythmic sense, and I could still recognize the ballade by its rhythmic structure. A few minutes later, just as the piece was ending, normal tonality returned. Greatly puzzled by all this, when I got home, I phoned the radio station and asked them if this had been some sort of experiment or joke. They said no, of course not, and suggested that I get my radio checked. A few weeks later, I had a similar episode while playing a Chopin mazurka on my piano. There was again a profound loss of tone, and the music seemed to decompose into a disconcerting racket, along with an unpleasant metallic reverberation. But this time it was accompanied by a brilliant, scintillating zigzag expanding in half of my visual field. I had often experienced such zigzags during attacks of migraine. Now, it was evident, I was experiencing an amusia as part of a migraine aura. Still, when I went downstairs and spoke to my landlord, I found that my voice and his voice sounded perfectly normal. It was only music and not speech or sound in general that was so strangely affected. My experience, like most of those described in the neurological literature, was of an acquired amusia, one that I found startling and frightening, but also fascinating. Were there, I wondered, people with congenital amusia of an equally extreme degree? I was startled to find the following passage in Nabokov's autobiography, Speak, Memory. Music, I regret to say, affects me merely as an arbitrary succession of more or less irritating sounds. The concert piano and all wind instruments bore me in small doses and flay me in larger ones. I do not know what to make of this, for Nabokov is such a jester, such an ironist, that one is never sure whether to take him seriously. But it is conceivable, at least, that in the Pandora's box of his multitudinous gifts there was, along with these, perhaps, a profound amusia. I had met the French neurologist François Lhermitte, who once told me that when he heard music, he could say only that it was the Marseillaise, or that it was not. His ability to recognize melodies stopped there. He did not seem distressed by this, nor had he ever had the impulse to investigate its neural basis. It was simply the way he was, and had always been. I should have asked him how he recognized the Marseillaise. Was it by its rhythm or the sound of a particular instrument? By the behavior or attention of other people around him? And what did it actually sound like to him? I wondered when and how he had discovered his amusia, and what effect, if any, it had on his life. But we had only a few minutes together, and conversation veered to other topics. I would not meet another person with complete congenital amusia for another 20 years, and only then through the kindness of my colleague Isabel Peretz, a pioneer in the study of neuroscience and music. In late 2006, Peretz introduced me to D.L., an intelligent, young-looking, 76-year-old woman who has never heard music, though she seems to hear, recognize, remember, and enjoy other sounds and speech without difficulty. Mrs. L. recollected that when she was in kindergarten, children were asked to sing their names, as in, "My name is Mary Adams." She could not do this, and did not know what was meant by singing, nor could she perceive what the other children were doing. In second or third grade, she said, there was a music appreciation class in which 5 pieces, including the William Tell Overture, were played. "I could never tell which piece was being played," she said. When her father heard of this, he got a Victrola and records of the 5 pieces. "He played them again and again," she said, "but it didn't help." He also got her a little toy piano or xylophone that could be played by numbers, and she learned in this way to play Mary Had a Little Lamb and Frère Jacques, while having no sense that she was producing anything but noise. If others played these songs, she could not tell whether they made mistakes, But if she herself made a mistake, she would feel this, she said, in my fingers, not by hearing. She came from a very musical family. Everyone played an instrument, and her mother would always ask her, why don't you like music the way the other girls do? A family friend who was a learning specialist tested her with pitches. DL was asked to stand up if a note was higher than another, or to sit down if it was lower. But this, too, failed. I could not tell if one note was higher than the other, she said. DL was told as a little girl that her voice was monotonous when she recited poetry, and one teacher set herself to tutor her in inflections and intonations, to read dramatically. This apparently was successful, for I could not detect anything abnormal in her speech. Indeed, she now spoke warmly of Byron and Sir Walter Scott, and when I asked her to, she recited The Lay of the Last Minstrel with expression and feeling. She enjoyed poetry readings and going to the theatre. She had no difficulty recognizing people's voices, nor did she have difficulty recognizing all sorts of sounds around her. Water running, wind blowing, cars hooting, dogs barking. D.L. loved tap dancing as a girl, was very good at it, and could tap dance on skates. She said she was a street kid and liked to perform with other kids on the street. She seemed, therefore, to have a good sense of rhythm in her body and now likes rhythmic aerobics. But if there was a musical accompaniment, this would throw her off and interfere with her dancing. When I tapped a simple rhythm with my pencil, like the opening of Beethoven's Fifth or a bit of Morse code, Mrs. L. could easily imitate it. But if the rhythm was embedded in a complex melody, she had much more trouble, and the rhythm tended to be lost in the overall noisy confusion she heard. During junior high school, D.L. developed a liking for war songs. This was in the mid-1940s. I recognized them because of their words, she said. Anything with words is okay. Her father, newly encouraged, bought records of war songs. But, she remembered, if an orchestra was in the background, it drove me crazy, like sounds coming from all different directions, overwhelming noise. People often ask Mrs. L. what she hears when music is played, and she answers, if you were in my kitchen and threw all the pots and pans on the floor, that's what I hear. Later, she said that she was very sensitive to high notes, and that if she went to an opera, it all sounded like screaming. I couldn't recognize the Star-Spangled Banner, Mrs. L. said. I had to wait until others stood up. She also failed to recognize Happy Birthday to You, even though when she became a teacher, she would play a recording of it at least 30 times a year when any of my students had a birthday. When she was in college, a professor did some hearing tests on all of his students and told D.L. that she had impossible results. He wondered if she could, in fact, perceive music. Around this time, she started going out with boyfriends. I went to all these musicals, she told me, including Oklahoma. My father managed to cough up enough for a 90-cent seat. She would sit through these musicals. They were not too bad, she said, if only one person was singing, as long as it was not too high. She mentioned that when her mother had a stroke and was admitted to a nursing home, all sorts of activities, but especially music, delighted and calmed her. But Mrs. L. said that if she were in the same position, music would make her worse, drive her mad. 7 or 8 years ago, Mrs. L. saw an article in the New York Times about Isabel Peretz's work on amusia, and she said to her husband, "That's what I have." Although she had never thought of her problem as psychological or emotional, as her mother seemed to, she had not explicitly thought of it as neurological. Excitedly, she wrote to Peretz, and in her subsequent meeting with Peretz and Krista Hyde, she was reassured that the condition was real, not in her mind, and that others had it as well. She got in touch with other A-Music people and feels that now, with a bona fide condition, she can excuse herself from going to musical events. She wishes that a diagnosis of amusia had been made when she was 7 rather than 70, This might have saved her from a lifetime of being bored or excruciated by concerts to which she went only out of politeness. In 2002, Ayotte, Peretz and Hyde published a paper, Congenital Amusia, a group study of adults afflicted with a music-specific disorder in the journal Brain, based on their investigation of 11 subjects. Most of them had normal perception of speech and environmental sounds, but the majority were profoundly impaired in recognizing melodies and in pitch discrimination, unable to distinguish between adjacent tones and semitones. Without these basic building blocks, there can be no sense of a tonal center or key, no sense of scale or melody or harmony, any more than, in a spoken language, one can have words without syllables. When Mrs. L. compared the sound of music to that of pots and pans being thrown around the kitchen, I was puzzled, for it seemed to me that pitch discrimination alone, however defective, would not produce such an experience. It was as if the whole character, the timbre of musical notes, was being radically undermined. Timbre is the particular quality or acoustic richness of a sound produced by an instrument or a voice, independent of its pitch or loudness. It is what distinguishes a middle C played on a piano from the same note played on a saxophone. The timbre of a sound is influenced by all sorts of factors, including the frequencies of harmonics or overtones, and the onset, rise, and decay of acoustic waveforms. The ability to maintain a sense of timbre constancy is a multi-leveled and extremely complex process in the auditory brain that may have some analogies with colour constancy. Indeed, the language of colour is often applied to timbre, which is sometimes referred to as sound colour or tone colour. I had a similar impression reading Hekean and Albert's case history of the man for whom music was transformed into the sound of a screeching car, and with my own experience of a Chopin ballade sounding as if it were being banged out on a sheet of steel. And Robert Silvers has written to me of how Joseph Alsop, the journalist, used to tell me that the music I admired, or indeed any music, for him was something like the sound of a horse-drawn carriage passing over cobbled streets. These cases, like D.L.'s, differed somewhat from the cases of pure pitch amusia, described by Ayotte et al. In 2002. The term dysdambria is beginning to be used to denote such experiences, and to be recognized as a distinct form of amusia that may coexist with defective pitch discrimination, or occur on its own. Timothy Griffiths, A.R. Jennings and Jason Warren recently reported the striking case of a 42-year-old man who, after suffering a right hemisphere stroke, experienced dysdambria without any alteration of pitch perception. Mrs. L., it would seem, has both congenital dysdambria and impairments of pitch perception. One might think, too, that a gross dysdambria for musical notes would make speech sound very different, and perhaps unintelligible. But this was not the case with Mrs. L. Indeed, Balan, Zatori and their colleagues have found voice-selective areas in the auditory cortex that are anatomically separate from the areas involved in the perception of musical timbre. I asked Mrs. L. how she felt about her failure to get music. Was she ever curious or wistful about what others were feeling? She replied that she had been curious as a child. If I had a wish, it would be to hear music as others heard it. But she no longer gives this much thought. She cannot perceive or imagine what others are enjoying so much, but she has many other interests and does not think of herself as defective or as missing an essential part of life. She is simply the way she is and always has been. Later, reflecting on this, Mrs. L. brought up a passage that had struck her from my book The Island of the Colorblind. I had described a totally congenitally colorblind friend who had said, "As a kid, I used to think it would be nice to see colors. I suppose it might open up a new world, as if one were tone-deaf and suddenly become able to hear melodies. It would probably be a very interesting thing, but it would be confusing." Mrs. L was intrigued by this and said, "If I were to hear melodies by some miracle, would I also be confused? Would I have to learn what melody is first? How would I know what I was hearing?" In 1990, Isabelle Peretz and her colleagues in Montreal devised a special battery of tests for evaluating amusia, and they have been able, in many cases, to identify the broad neural correlates of certain types of amusia. They feel that there are two basic categories of musical perception, one involving the recognition of melodies, the other the perception of rhythm or time intervals. Impairments of melody usually go with right hemisphere lesions, but representation of rhythm is much more widespread and robust, and involves not only the left hemisphere, but many subcortical systems in the basal ganglia, the cerebellum, and other areas. There are many further distinctions. Thus, some individuals can appreciate rhythm but not meter, and others have the reverse problem. There are yet other forms of amusia, all probably with their own specific neural bases. There may be an impairment of the ability to perceive dissonance, the discordant sound produced by a major second, for example, something that is normally recognized and reacted to even by infants. Gosselin Sampson and others in Peretz's lab have reported that loss of this ability, and nothing else, may occur with particular types of neurological lesion. They tested a number of subjects in discriminating dissonant from non-dissonant music, and found that only those with extensive damage to an area involved in emotional judgments, the parahippocampal cortex, were affected. Such subjects were able to judge consonant music to be pleasant and to judge music as happy or sad, but they did not show the normal response to dissonant music, which they rated as slightly pleasant. In a quite different category, for it has nothing to do with the cognitive aspects of appreciating music, there can be a partial or total loss of the feeling or emotions normally evoked by music, even though perception of music is unimpaired. This too has its own specific neural basis and is discussed further in Chapter 24, Seduction and Indifference. In most cases, an inability to hear melodies is the consequence of very poor pitch discrimination and a distorted perception of musical tones. But some people may lose the ability to recognize melodies, even though they can hear and discriminate the component tones perfectly. This is a higher-order problem, a tune deafness or amelodia, analogous to the losing of sentence structure or meaning, perhaps, though words themselves are intact. Such a person hears a sequence of notes, but the sequence seems arbitrary, seems to have no logic or purpose, makes no musical sense. What such amusic seem to be lacking, wrote Ayotte et al., is the knowledge and procedures required for mapping pitches and musical scales. In a recent letter, my friend Lawrence Weschler wrote, "I have an excellent sense of rhythm, and yet I am almost completely amusical in another sense. The missing element for me is the ability to hear the relations between notes, and hence, orally, to appreciate their interactions and interweavings. If you were to play two relatively close notes on the piano, say, within an octave, I would likely not be able to tell you whether one was higher than the other, whether, say, in any given sequence of notes you had gone up and up and then down and down and then up, or the reverse. Curiously, I have a relatively good sense of melody, or rather, melodic memory, in that I can, tape recorder-like, hum back a tune or even take to whistling or humming it with relative fidelity, days or weeks after being exposed to it. But I couldn't even tell you in my own humming if a particular melodic trill were going up or down. I have always been this way." Some years ago, my colleague Stephen Spahr told me of a patient of his, Professor B., a greatly gifted musician, who had played double bass with the New York Philharmonic under Toscanini, was the author of a major textbook in musical appreciation, and a close friend of Arnold Schoenberg's. Now, at 91, Spahr wrote, "Professor B., still articulate, vibrant, and very much intellectually alive, had had a stroke that left him suddenly unable to discern a tune as simple as Happy Birthday. His perception of pitch and rhythm was perfectly intact. It was only their synthesis into melody that was gone. Yet Professor B was admitted to the hospital with weakness of the left side, and on the day of admission had hallucinations of a choir singing. He was unable to identify Handel's Messiah, played to him on the bedside music channel, or Happy Birthday, hummed to him by Dr. Spar. Professor B did not recognize either piece of music, but he did not acknowledge any problem, maintaining that his difficulties were due to poor fidelity of the recording equipment and that Dr. Spar's humming was mere pseudo-vocalization. Professor B could immediately get a melody by reading its notation. His musical imagery was intact, and he could hum a melody himself quite accurately. His problem was wholly one of auditory processing, an inability to hold an auditory sequence of notes in memory. While there have been many accounts of such melody deafness coming on after a head injury or stroke, I had not heard of a harmony deafness until I met Rachel Y.